Before we start our episode today, this is just a reminder. History Hack does have a Patreon account and all of your donations are gratefully appreciated. There's lots of perks on there, secret groups on Facebook. Do get involved. We would love to see more of you. Enjoy the episode today. Hello and welcome to another installment of History Hack. We have he did it himself. Zach has dragged himself, kicking and screaming, into the 20th century for some military history today, haven't you, Zach?
I have. Hello, boss. It's good to see you. This is a bit of an odd one because I've got two bosses in the room with me.
I've
got you as podcast boss, and then we are joined by Professor Kendrick Oliver, who is the head of history at the University of Southampton. So he's, in effect, my other boss.
Is that why you're wearing a shirt with a collar? And
I even had a shave. Just for you guys. So I've made the effort. Not that anybody can see that. That's a great comment to make.
Contrary to popular belief, Zach does actually need to shave.
Just because he looks like a four-year-old doesn't mean he actually is. But anyway, Kendrick is the author of a number of brilliant books looking at American history, including The My Lai Massacre in American History and Memory, and To Touch the Face of God, The Sacred, the Profane, and the American Space Program. He's going to be talking to us today about the Vietnam War, something that you've probably seen from, I don't know, Apocalypse Now or Platoon, but which really is far more complex than you would ever believe by watching the film. Kendrick, it's great to see you. Hello. I hope I've said enough nice things to placate my
about,
other boss.
Just about enough, thank you. Yeah.
How are you doing?
I'm fine, thank you. It's lovely to be here.
Nobody likes a crawler, Zach. Rein it in.
Yeah, all right then.
Although I'm now looking at this thing thinking, why are we doing the Vietnam War and not the space program? That would be awesome. So we'll just have to have Kendrick back again.
See, this was the plan. Really, you in with the Vietnam War, the hint of a space program, and I knew you'd want him back for more.
You knew if you mentioned rockets to me that I'd be sold, didn't you?
Absolutely.
Should we start?
We probably should, shouldn't we? Let's take this back to the basics, shall we? Inevitably. The conflict in Vietnam, how does it start? I know that's a very kind of simple question, but it's an important one. So how do we get to a point where there is a war in Vietnam?
So I guess we have to start with French colonialism in Indochina, which in the sort of interwar period basically encompasses modern-day Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos. And, you know, it's a pretty horrible colonial regime. Probably as you can imagine, and it sort of helps to sort of stimulate the growth of sort of Vietnamese nationalist networks. Some of those networks have links to the Soviet regime in Moscow. Ho Chi Minh, who's probably the most well-known of these nationalist leaders, spent some time in Moscow. But you know, the nature of the kind of French colonialism means there's quite a lot of sort of reasons, local, entirely local reasons, indigenous reasons, why you'd be kind of you might want to kind of resist or be opposed to the French colonial regime. And what happens, basically, the Second World War unsettles things quite a lot, because the French colonial regime in Indochina aligns itself to the Vichy regime in France. And essentially rules Indochina on behalf of the Japanese until about 1945, when the Japanese overthrow that French colonial regime. And so we have a sort of situation where French colonial authority has been sort of doubly eviscerated. It's been eviscerated by the Germans in Europe, but it's also been eviscerated by the Japanese in Asia. Whilst the Japanese, as we know, are also on the way out, their kind of empire is retreating, and that creates a kind of vacuum which many different kind of actors are seeking to fill. So you have the Viet Minh and other kind of nationalist groupings in Vietnam itself. You have the Free French, who are under Charles de Gaulle, who are seeking to sort of, you know, establish themselves as the kind of the one true French government, and are interested in maintaining or resurrecting a kind of imperial presence. And the United States is the kind of great power that has the sort of authority and the power to decide who's going to get to do what. Does it want to kind of buttress the reputation of the de Gaulle regime by licensing de Gaulle's aspiration for re-establishment of French empire? Or does it want to kind of align itself with the aspirations of the kind of decolonizing world? But this is, of course, just one of the thousands of problems that are crossing the desk of American policymakers at this point. They're really kind of wrestling with you know, a rapidly changing world, as you know, Germany is, you know, defeated and the Japanese are heading towards defeat too. And we think, you know, Franklin Roosevelt is sort of hostile to US to French colonialism, but his successor, when Roosevelt dies, Harry Truman is much less experienced, doesn't know and really what's going on here, and he ends up sort of defaulting to basically what the kind of Europeanists in the US State Department want, which is to let the French back in, facilitated by British forces. And so basically for a period of a year, to cut the long story short, 1945 and 1946, there's this sort of period of tension where you have the French coming back in, the French colonial regime seeking to establish itself, and the Viet Minh in particular, they're basically kind of, there's this sort of debate and attention about what post-war French colonialism in Indochina is going to look at. Is it, it look like? Is it going to allow aspirations for self-government or not? And, you know, and what happens basically is that a war breaks out at the end of 1946, once it becomes fairly clear that the French colonial regime is not terribly interested in accommodating Vietnamese aspirations for self-government.
So this isn't the first. So by the time we get to the early 60s or the mid 60s and America comes into this, this isn't a sudden interest in this region. You've already pointed out that even at the beginning of World War II, at the end of World War II, they are actively involved in trying to shape how things progress in Southeast Asia. And they've been involved in the Korean War as well, haven't they? So how does this develop? How does America's interest in this region develop to the point that they get involved in Vietnam?
Sure. So basically by 1949, the war is essentially a bit of a stalemate. The French haven't managed to defeat the Viet Minh, but the Viet Minh are sort of operating in the shadows. They don't have access to the major cities, and it looks like it's going to be a long haul. And basically the fall of China changes everything. The fall of China in late 1949 changes everything. The Americans are much more interested in Indochina because obviously there's been this huge change in the kind of geopolitical landscape as a result of China falling to communism. Whereas the Viet Minh have access to China now as a kind of strategic hinterland for their own aspirations. Stalin, who has paid very little interest to the Viet Minh before, agrees to kind of recognize the Viet Minh as the Democratic Republic of Vietnam. And so in the wake of that, you get the US giving aid to the French, and the Chinese giving aid to the Viet Minh, and the war basically enters a new stage from about sort of 1950 onwards, where it's really of interest to the major post-war powers, albeit one that's kind of simmering at a kind of lower level of intensity to the Korean War. You know, we don't have U.S. direct U.S. troop involvement in Vietnam at this point in the way that you do with Korea, and that lasts to about 1954 when. The French are getting pretty exhausted. There's a siege of the French garrison at Dien Bien Phu in northern Vietnam. And that kind of results in the Geneva Conference of 1954, which produces a division of the country into a communist north and a non-communist south. And the Americans are then trying to sort of work out what they do with this new landscape. Do they want to support the non-communist government of Ngo Dinh Diem in the south, which has many problems of its own? And basically they only make that decision in the spring of 1955 when Diem seems strong enough. He's defeated some key local opponents and he seems strong enough therefore to sort of ally with. And it's then that they start supporting him properly. They start giving him economic aid. They start giving him military aid. They start announcing that he's the kind of miracle man of Southeast Asia. He seems like he could be a genuine competitor to the Viet Minh, the Democratic Republic of Vietnam in the north. And so what they're hoping for at that point is the same sort of semi-permanent arrangement as they've got in Korea. There's a non-communist south, there's a communist north. They can ignore the issue of reunification and just support the Diem regime in the south. Of course, this means that the North Vietnamese have their own kind of decision to make as well, because you know their aspiration has always been for unification. Do you accept that you've just got this kind of fait accompli where they just have to sort of focus on what they're doing in the north, or do they continue to try and you know take over the south? Do they keep hold of that goal? And knowing that if they go for military insurgency in the south, it's going to precipitate American military involvement, or is likely to. And basically, just Xi'an makes the decision for them. In the late 1950s, Xi'an starts repressing communists in South Vietnam. He also stimulates local opposition to his regime. And basically, you have this kind of uprising taking place in South Vietnam against the Xi'an regime. And the North Vietnamese have to make a decision at this point because it seems to be escaping their control. You have all these people sort of rebelling against Xi'an, but they may not be attached to North Vietnam. They may not be these sort of they may not belong to the revolution in quite the same way. So they have to quickly sort of announce their support for revolutionary activity in the South in order to kind of retain authority over the revolution. So an armed insurgency begins. Northern volunteers start coming down, but it's really essentially a southern phenomenon at this point, and it's pretty successful. The US gives some massively increases the aid to the Xi'an regime in 1962, but the insurgency is spreading. The Xi'an regime, its kind of horizon of control shrinks. There's an increase in political opposition, particularly from Buddhists. There's dissent in the military. Xi'an's regime is overthrown about a month before Kennedy gets assassinated in late 1963, but the chaos continues. And so we end up with this period in 1964, 1965, when US policymakers are kind of wrestling with this decision. Do you give up South Vietnam as a kind of basket case, as a dead loss? You know, they've already put a lot of aid into it. There's no political stability in the country. Or do you think the solution to this is to go in with your own forces? You stabilize the situation using US military forces. And the Johnson administration decides to go in. It has these kind of ideas of credibility. It's what the Allies would like because they would like the United States to perform a kind of support for Allies in trouble, even if actually most Allies don't really want the United States to go in to South Vietnam. They think there are more pressing problems that America has to deal with. And Johnson and his advisors are concerned with their own kind of personal and political credibility. Too. The advisors are the ones that supported Kennedy or that were advised Kennedy, and they made a series of decisions that were sort of escalating, and therefore they're kind of baked into this issue. Johnson is, you know, he has a certain amount of machismo. He doesn't want to be the first president to sort of lose a war or to leave South Vietnam and risk a kind of conservative critiques from that. And so they make a decision to send ground troops in.
So when they make that decision, how popular is the war initially? Because there are two ways of looking at this. One is, you know, look to what happened in the Korean War, a conflict there that leads to a stalemate, nothing really changes. The flip side, of course, is that America has been for a long time wrestling with its own concerns about communism and internal threats to communism. So which side kind of wins out in this discussion of whether or not at the moment that the Americans are starting to fight, this is or is not a good idea?
It's really difficult to say that it's popular in the sense that the most Americans at that point won't know where Vietnam is on the map. And certainly in the period from 1964 through to early 65, when the kind of the question of what are we going to do is really alive in political circles, at least. Newspapers, senior politicians, including Democratic politicians, are really quite ambivalent about what to do. And they see South Vietnam and they don't see much evidence of sort of hope that anything's going to go well there, even if you do send troops. The public doesn't really know. So I think one can make the case that the Lyndon Johnson had the political capital at this moment, having taken over from an assassinated president. He's on his way to a landslide victory in 1964. He has the political capital to go the other way. It would involve a cost. There would undoubtedly be complaints from right wingers about stepping away from South Vietnam, but he could sell that. It would be perfectly possible for him to sell that, to the American people as a sort of sensible decision to make. Once the commitment is made and they start sending ground troops over the sort of spring and summer of 1965, there is a kind of rally around the flag phenomenon that, as you can imagine, does fade in time as these phenomena tend to. But it's also worth pointing out that support for maintaining the commitment is quite enduring. Through the 1960s, the decision, when you look at polls on the question, they ask two sort of questions. One is, you know, was the decision to go to war a mistake? And quite a lot of people will say it was. So the actual decision to go to war is regretted. But the need to stay, which is a slightly different question, is still a kind of feature of the political, of relatively mainstream political sentiment. I, once you're in, you need to see it through. And people are kind of haunted by the idea of a messy withdrawal. There's also that just, you know, the longer you're in, the more blood and treasure you sink into this. There's all those sort of sunken costs which need to be redeemed, hopefully by success. And so, you know, one of the things I think is really interesting about Vietnam is that the fragility of the sentiment supporting going in, but the enduring nature of the sentiment to persevere with it once they're in.
Is that because people are invested in this concept of domino theory and, you know, you can't let somewhere else fall? Or is it just, you know, blood has been, American blood has been spilt in this war and we therefore need that sacrifice to mean something in terms of an end result?
To some extent, both. I mean, it's difficult to disaggregate, you know, what polls don't often tell us exactly why people want to, you know, support the war. But I suspect that, you know, obviously the Cold War ideas that surround the kind of Cold War ideas of the domino theory, ideas of credibility, ideas of sort of national reputation, you know, do have an impact upon the way in which people think. But there's also just a sort of sense in which we've been in this now. And you know, my son and my brother has gone to Vietnam, and are we just going to sort of, you know, abandon? Make that sort of whatever sacrifice they've made, make it, you know, just retreat and cancel out whatever that was worth. And I think that counts for quite a lot too.
So in terms of when we look at the US military and the Viet Cong, there's this perception, isn't there, of David versus Goliath. But as we know, the war doesn't unfold in a way that you'd expect looking at the forces on paper. Why wasn't the USA successful in the conflict? Is it the terrain, the strategy, the wider political decisions making, or is there as a combination of all of those things?
Yeah, it's all those things. Yeah. That's a simple answer. But I mean, the terrain is not the sort of terrain that the US really likes fighting. It's not responsive to what we might call kind of capital intensive forms of war fighting. That is where you get machines and heavy munitions and things like tanks and aeroplanes and artillery to do the work of platoons of soldiers. You know, it's not a flat landscape like the plains of Europe. It's not or like the Gulf. The desert in the Gulf in a later conflict. And the Johnson administration, for all that it does, you know, increase draft calls and gets more people to, you know, we have 500,000 troops in Vietnam by 1968. It wants to generally avoid a kind of personnel intensive war. It wants to avoid calling up the reserves. It wants to avoid widening the draft as much as it can, because it knows that that's going to make the war unpopular. It's going to make the war very costly. The Great Society programs at home are going to be gutted. And so it tries to basically make Vietnam a place where it can successfully apply its firepower. And you know, as if it were kind of flattening the terrain, it creates these things called free fire zones where it moves the civilian population out of those zones so it can fire on, it can do whatever it likes in terms of dropping bombs and artillery into those areas. It strips the forest, as we know, with defoliants. And all of that, of course, comes at an enormous cost to South Vietnamese society, whilst in many ways also reduces the South Vietnamese support for the kind of American, what's become by this point an American client regime in South Vietnam. The South Vietnamese government is basically presiding over the destruction of its own society, and it's never going to attract much more than temporary support or support, basically support from people who are in that regime too deep to have any kind of way out, to have any alternative. This doesn't mean that the kind of insurgency is lovely either. It's engaged in acts of terrorism. And it's undoubtedly affected by American firepower, the ability of the United States to sort of unleash all of this upon the Vietnamese countryside disrupts the momentum of the revolution quite a lot. If you're looking at the kind of revolution in 1964, 1965, they're pretty hopeful of a quick end to all of this. And then the Americans come in and they have to start thinking about a time frame of, you know, a victory in 3, 4, 5 years time. And that takes quite a lot of momentum. It has an impact upon morale. It leads to decisions like the 1968 Tet Offensive, for example, which involves a massive overestimation of domestic South Vietnamese support for the revolution in South Vietnamese cities. So it's not like the American military isn't causing the revolution problems. But it's also the case that the Americans find it very difficult to move out of this kind of catch-22 situation, is that the more that they try and apply firepower to the situation, the further they almost become from their goal.
Is there an appreciation of that amongst policymakers, that, you know, you're obliterating these people's landscapes and then at the same time trying to get them to align with a political ideal that you are supporting? Does that compute with people?
It does for some, and there is a division of opinion within the U.S. military. Certainly, in the first sort of year of the major commitments, or 65 to 66, that do we go for pacification, which is the idea that you hold on to territory, particularly around the sort of the cities and along the coast, and you protect the people and you try and build up the sort of infrastructure and you bind them to the regime by, proving the value of the regime to their own lives? Or do you try and destroy the enemy? And the choice that's made is to try and destroy the enemy, to try and destroy the insurgency. So it's sort of reaching for a military solution to, as opposed to what we might regard as a sort of social or political solution. And so there is a debate within the US military at this point. The Marines are quite keen on pacification. The US Army under General William Westmoreland doesn't think it has the time for pacification to work. Pacification is hard. It involves people having to do things that they're not really trained to do, whereas soldiers are trained to fight. So send them out into the countryside and get them to sort of kill people. Rather crudely, that's what their mission is. And so Westmoreland puts all his money, as it were, in the kind of search and destroy attritional basket.
And you were talking about the regime, and I do want to dwell on the politics a bit more here because it is so key. What kind of regime are the USA supporting in Saigon? Because you think about figures like Madam Nu, who becomes, in many cases, sort of almost a cover person for the South Vietnamese regime. She's not a particularly benevolent person to have really associated with the USA in any sense. What are we dealing with here in terms of personalities and their decision-making process?
So it's not a very nice regime. That is right. It's just not well populated with liberal humanitarians. That's the case. But look at most post-colonial client regimes of this period, and they're often pretty nasty. South Korea's a police state for quite a long period. There are massacres in Indonesia, the Philippines under Ferdinand Marcos. Also not a particularly kind of a poster child for liberal government. So in that sense, sort of South Vietnam doesn't stand out too much, I don't think, despite figures like Madame Nu and North Vietnam is also unlovely in many respects. Civil wars tend to be kind of vicious, and that's to some extent what we're dealing with here. Especially when they're especially vicious when both sides have some access to sort of superpower arsenals. In terms of the sort of ZM regime, historians have argued about this. Some see ZM as fatally inept, inauthentic, authoritarian. He's unwilling to sort of broaden his base by involving people beyond his own family, and therefore, it's a very shallow regime in terms of its the sort of horizon of its political support. He's Catholic, and the nation's essentially sort of Buddhist. According to these more critical historians, he's basically sort of uninterested or distant from the sort of an understanding of the real needs of his people. Other historians, however, have been a bit more sympathetic, arguing that he's pretty much doing an impossible job. South Vietnam, at the moment that he takes over in sort of 54, 55, is a basket case. It's not a society or a political system that that it's going to be very easy to build much out of. And he actually does wrestle some kind of order and authority, some degree of order and authority out of it. He tries to pursue a kind of a model of modernization. Until you get this kind of combination of armed insurgency and sort of increased American expectations following their kind of injection of aid. And those twin things kind of do for him, according to this sort of way of thinking about the Diem regime. Personally, I'm not sure he was up to it, but it's difficult to identify someone else who was in that politics at that point. Although that's partly because Diem himself didn't exactly foster the careers of political rivals, so there wasn't going to be.
This is a war that drags on from one US administration to another, isn't it? And there's even like a famous satirical cartoon where it shows each successive president just passing the blame onto the guy before. How bad is it, the buck passing, when it comes to Vietnam?
Yeah, I mean, it makes a difference because you know, Johnson invokes Kennedy when making the decisions for war, even though Kennedy himself was much more hesitant about sending the idea of sending ground troops to
long dead as well, isn't he?
Well, I mean, so that's it. Sort of interesting. So Kennedy obviously dies at the end of 1963, and you could see the whole of 1964 as being the sort of the time when the Johnson administration is wrestling with the what next question. And when it comes to sort of trying to justify that, Johnson will often make reference to sort of Kennedy as you know, what I'm doing was in line with Kennedy's commitment to South Vietnam, even if that at that point that commitment didn't involve US ground troops. Nixon, meanwhile, when he comes in 1969, likes to refer to the war as a, you know, once it becomes clear that this war is not terribly popular, likes to refer to the war as a kind of democratic, as a war that the Democrats have got America into, even if he was vice president of, you know, he was Eisenhower's vice president during the 1950s when the first decisions in favor of the Diem regime were being made. So yes, as a means of claiming the support of precedent, but also as a means of, as a way of explaining how you're clearing up the mess left by others. History is a kind of resource for these presidents, but it's also a way for them to avoid thinking about the situation that they were actually in and how to get out of it in that particular moment, which can be a danger for historians too, that, you know, we sort of accept that historians are, that presidents were too kind of bound by circumstance, too bound by past patterns, whereas in fact, you know, maybe they had the power to change those circumstances. Johnson had the power to decide not to go to war in 1964 and 1965. Nixon had the power to decide to bring the troops home in 1969 rather than, you know, 1973. And so I think it's quite important to recognize that that when presidents talk about precedent and what other people have done and the situation that they've inherited, that that's sometimes a way of explaining why they're not creating changes that they actually have the power to enact.
So what kind of effect does that have? Because it creates a very confused picture, does it not? For people to say, well, you know, I've got no choice. You know, this is something that's been lumped upon me by a previous administration, and now I'm just trying to muddle my way through. And we elect politicians fundamentally to make difficult decisions. So when you have this mounting death toll, when you have events such as we'll come on to, like the My Lai massacre, and you have these policymakers and people as high as the president themselves saying, well, but is it really something that I, you know, my hands are tied here? How does this all kind of come together in terms of creating what becomes a very unpopular conflict in the eyes of the American people?
So it doesn't really come together. Is the answer to that. You know, yes, the war becomes progressively more unpopular. Although, as I said, the slope of decline is shallower than you might think in terms of its popularity. But what we have to recognize is when you see those sort of poll figures for that measure popularity, unpopularity, was it right to go to the war? Do you support the president's policies? That you have to unpack those because different people think in different ways and they're rationalizing their answers in different ways. So the distaste of a college student for a conflict that he might be drafted to fight in is different from the distaste of a returning veteran who comes back to an economy in recession and wonders why he made the sacrifice that he did. It's different from the businessman who's worried about the tax increases to pay for the war, the inflationary effects of the war. It's different from the foreign policy expert who's concerned about this being a distraction from other kind of key priorities. It's different from the conservative who thinks that the war is being fought for, you know, with too many restraints. You know, and about one fifth of Americans, you know, are willing to contemplate the use of nuclear weapons in Vietnam. You know, when asked. So you can have people who want the war to be over, who also hate the anti-war movement and want an amplification of military force to do the job. And Nixon is a smart person, and he knows this, and he knows that he could use this. You know, so I think the sort of striking thing about the war is not really how quickly support for it fades, but how long presidents were able to keep support for the commitment going, partly by dividing and ruling the possible constituencies that were not in favor of the conflict by that point, and by manipulating the different reasons that they had for that. So, you know, both Johnson and Nixon are able to kind of vilify the anti-war movement and create a link between public opposition to the conflict, to sort of stigmatize public opposition to the conflict, by associating political and cultural radicalism, the sort of things that the bits of the anti-war movement are doing, like trying to levitate the Pentagon or vote a pig in as president. You know, that doing that sort of thing is a very good, drawing attention to those sort of things is a very good way of making sure that many other Americans who have reservations about the conflict don't go out on the streets.
Can I ask you now about the effect on Vietnamese people of this war? So the My Lai massacre is obviously one aspect of that. For those who aren't familiar, can you just outline for us what happens there?
Yeah, so My Lai is located in a village called Son My, which is near the coast of central South Vietnam. It's just outside the sort of city of Wang Nai. And there's quite a revolutionary presence in that. Area and that resulted in the deaths of you know, some U.S. soldiers during kind of operations in the kind of post Tet period of the early months of 1968. And so on the 16th of March 1968, a U.S. task force comprised of three infantry companies went into Son My village, and two of them, and they're significantly apart from each other geographically, they're about a mile apart. Son My village it's not a village that we might think of. It clustered around a church with a kind of village store. It's a geographical area. So these two companies are about a mile or so away from each other. And they both carry out massacres. And in total, probably killing somewhere in the region of 350 to 500 people, having received very little in the way of opposing fire. Many of the victims, you know, elderly, their women, their children, shot at point blank range, often en masse, in groups. There's soldiers also rape some of the women, which, you know, gives you an indication this is not a battle. You know, this is 4 hours of sort of mayhem and slaughter. So, you know, that's the My Lai massacre. It's to some extent it's misnamed, because My Lai is just one of the, there's a sort of a sub hamlet in Son My village, which is the Americans call My Lai 4. And that's how it gets the name My Lai Massacre.
Is that not that film with Michael J. Fox? It's a truly terrible film, but it has that plot line that is about him being this one American soldier that's stopping other people raping this girl. I think it's been years since I saw it in that. What are war crimes like? How prevalent are they?
So the film you're thinking of, I think, is Casualties of War.
That's it.
I think, yeah. Which is actually based on a different a factual case that was reported by, I think, the New Yorker. I may be wrong about that. So it's a different case, and it's a different scenario where a small group of U.S. soldiers basically kidnap a girl from a village and she is raped and killed, and then it's about the kind of the attempt to get justice for that thereafter. It's really difficult to tell. So after the My Lai massacre, it's really difficult to tell the extent of war crimes. And you know, what I think we can say is that it is, the situation is different in different locales and at different times. partly depending on what the war is like, but also who's in charge of it. Leadership matters a lot in terms of what troops think they can get away with, what they want to do, the kind of cues that they're, the behavioral cues that they're getting from the people around them. So after the My Lai massacre gets revealed, and perhaps we'll talk a little bit more about this anyway, in November 1969, the Nixon administration is really concerned about what this will do to in terms of public opinion. And it sets up what's called the Vietnam War Crimes Working Group to try and work out whether this is unusual, what other instances of these sort of atrocities might come through and into the press to cause trouble for public opinion. And so that's actually one of the best resources we have, is that the investigations of this Vietnam War Crimes Working Group. But it's probably only the tip of the iceberg. We know that there are others, not on the scale of My Lai, but on a smaller scale, there's numerous instances of killings and rapes that go to court martial. But we also know that's going to be the tip of the iceberg, because most of those cases, the units that are involved are not going to be reporting them. The people who are the victims of it are not going to be reporting this. But at the same time, we had to be very careful, because there's plenty of US servicemen who went through their service in Vietnam and we have to assume that they acted perfectly honorably. It's sort of somewhere between the two. It's not happening everywhere, but it's happening more than we really have information about.
Can I stay with what you were talking about there about kind of consequences and fallouts? And I'm interested in two kind of aspects of this. One is the US domestic fallout and kind of the reaction of people back home when this news breaks. And that is, fundamentally what happens, that this kind of becomes a moment of national scandal. But at the same time, you've got the impact on the Vietnamese people. You know, to what extent is My Lai, you talk about kind of tip of the iceberg in terms of what we know about, but to what extent are these kind of experiences more mainstream, or to what extent do the Vietnamese people suffer in other ways through things like the Agent Orange program and defoliation and so on?
Okay, so really, really good question. So let's deal with the first, which is, the United States. I mean, so the Americans don't learn about this until about 20 months after the massacre happened. There's a kind of cover up at the local level. Local commanders in the Wang Nai area know that something pretty bad happened in Son My, especially around the sort of settlement of that they called My Lai Four. But rather than investigate it properly, which is going to have an impact upon their own kind of reputation as commanders, and it's going to get very messy, they cover it up. So word doesn't really reach the press until a new investigation takes place because of reports that reach the US Army in sort of the spring of 1969. And it's that investigation that we start getting stories coming through the press. So Seymour Hersh is a very famous investigative journalist, to some extent makes his name by following this story through. So November 1969, the story breaks, and within about a week or so, it comprises quite a lot. It comprises news of the investigation. It comprises testimony from soldiers who were actually involved, some of them actually confessing to having been involved in the killings there. And it also encompasses photographic evidence. So one of the soldiers who'd sort of followed the unit into My Lai, he was an army reporter, and he took photographs of the victims in color. And he sells those to Life magazine, which is one of the kind of mainstream American publications of the period. And those get shown on CBS television, those images, and they comprise, the most famous images of the My Lai massacre, bodies on the ground en masse and so on. And so pretty quickly, there's compelling evidence that mass killings occurred there. It's front page news. The Nixon administration, as I said, is sort of worried. But within within a month or so, it's a little bit like, the sound of crickets. Those who are opposed to the war were already opposed to the war, and therefore it's not going to shunt their opinion. Those who were prepared to accept Nixon's argument that the nation's credibility required the war to continue tended to take the view that bad things happen in war. And a good many Americans, perhaps not paying too close attention to who had killed whom in My Lai and how, argued, you know, maybe the problem in the past with American policy was that its US soldiers hadn't been tough enough. And so what happens over time when Lieutenant William Calley, who was in charge of the platoon that probably carried out the greatest portion of the killing, was prosecuted. He actually became a hero. People sing songs about him. And it doesn't really shift the dial of public opinion on the war. You know, if you look at opinion polls between sort of October 69 before the massacre revelations and sort of January 1970, it shifts about 1% in an anti-war direction. And that's pretty much consistent with the direction of travel anyway. You then wanted to know about Vietnam there's obviously the sort of an enormous amount of damage that the war does physically to Vietnam. There's, you know, the lives cut short, and it's very difficult to get figures for that, but they undoubtedly lie in the millions. We know about the disfiguring, the injuries that people suffer from, damage to the environment as a result of kind of chemical agents, defoliants, and so on. There's also just the dislocations in human patterns of being as a result of the free fire zones, which just move people out of the countryside into the cities, into refugee camps, drive women into prostitution to service sort of American soldiers in the cities, and just the general sense of a society that's becoming increasingly dependent upon American aid. So the kind of material effects are quite substantial, but there's also the political effects, which drive the kind of regimes of both the North and the South in different directions. And they increase. And I think what you see is an increasing measure of repression on both sides. And the effect of that is that when the North Vietnamese finally take over the South in 1975, it's essentially a hostile takeover by that point. It's a scenario where we get re-education camps for those who work for the South Vietnamese regime. A sort of exodus of sort of talent is sort of driven out of the country in stages. So we get, you know, refugees, the boat people, and because of that kind of that move to a kind of more ideological position under the sort of circumstances of conflict, we get the Socialist Republic of Vietnam, which is the kind of collective entity when unification happens, is very dependent and reliant upon a kind of Soviet model of economic modernization until the 1990s, until the end of the Cold War, the war has quite a prolonged effect in terms of the victims that it produces.
How does it all end eventually? So during the evacuation of NATO forces from Afghanistan, we saw people drawing comparisons with the last helicopters coming out of Saigon, but how do we get to that point?
By 1972, the US Congress is basically threatening to pull the plug on the Vietnam War. And that basically forces President Nixon to sort of come to terms with the North Vietnamese, where the Americans will withdraw, the North Vietnamese, and he's accepting under that agreement the continued presence of North Vietnamese troops in South Vietnam, even as the Americans leave. And so there's a variety at that point with the kind of Paris Peace Settlement of early 1973. There are a variety of kind of hopes and expectations that accompany the sort of settlement. Perhaps South Vietnam can survive, just like South Korea has done, with the peace sort of enforced by, you know, you help with America give military aid or economic aid to the South Vietnamese. If necessary, if the North Vietnamese violate the agreement, you can have strategic bombing of the North. Or perhaps the best that they can hope for is what's sometimes called a decent interval. You know, South Vietnam will eventually fall, but it'll be in about 3 or 4 years' time, at which point no one will be able to make. There'll be at best a dotted line between the Americans withdrawing and the collapse of this client regime. The problem with all this planning is that Watergate is about to kind of, you know, really kind of explode on the American scene, and American credit, you know, American political consensus gets shot. Any hope that Nixon had of being able to persuade Congress to maintain support for the South Vietnamese regime fades. The level of aid is gradually reduced for the South Vietnamese regime, and basically in towards the end of 1974, the start of 1975, the North Vietnamese sort of seize the initiative. It's exploratory in the first instance. They launch an offensive in early January 1975, and what they work out pretty quickly is, one, the Americans are unlikely to come back in, and secondly, the South Vietnamese regime is much more fragile than anyone had really sort of thought at that stage. The South Vietnamese regime basically collapses in a matter of months.
Was the Vietnam? I mean, this is I say this having spoken to you on a few occasions about this, so I know what you're going to say in response to this, which is why it's a bit of a cheeky question for me. But it's a response that floored me the first time you told me about this. Was the Vietnam War ever winnable for the USA, or was it always doomed to failure?
Oh, I wish I could remember what I told you, because probably what I'm going to say now is going to contradict whatever I said back then. I think we need to think about what winnable means. I mean, the war aims of the Americans are relatively clear, to my mind anyway. You know, you get the insurgency, you get the communist insurgency or the nationalist insurgency in the South down to a level that the Southern government can cope with by itself, and then the Americans sort of leave, or at least, you know, a substantial portion of them leave. But the problem is that the involvement of US forces makes that harder in many ways, not easier, because it stimulates more support to come from the North. And it also stimulates more support to come sort of via the North from the other major communist superpowers, from the Soviet Union and China. And so that, you know, the overall level of fighting increases. And it also makes US involvement also makes the government in the South much more dependent on the US, and actually less able then to take back the reins of fighting the war for itself. Now, by the sort of late 1960s, early 1970s, the Americans have sort of realized that they've made a rod for their own back here. And that, so the process of what's called Vietnamization begins, which is, you know, the idea is that you try and get the South Vietnamese trained up to do the fighting whilst the Americans keep pummeling the North with airstrikes. But the issue with that is that it's clearly done on US timetables, and it's not according to kind of measured stress tests of where the South Vietnamese are in that sort of process of being able to cope for themselves. And so what you end up with by sort of late 72, 73 is that, you know, the Paris Peace Settlement is essentially a toss-up. They're tossing a coin. It might work out. South Vietnam might survive. It might not. And certainly the South Vietnamese regime fears the outcome because the Americans have left, but the North Vietnamese are still in the South. So Vietnamization looks like an approach pointed in the kind of right direction, certainly pointed more in the right direction than the earlier search and destroy strategy. But by the point that it's actually carried out, it's been carried out against the clock. Everyone knows that. And, you know, it's difficult to sort of reach a point where it can actually be successful according to the timeframes of American politics, where by that point people want to leave.
You do a lot of work on the memory of the Vietnam War, and this is still well within living memory. So how is the war remembered and talked about in both nations? I mean, I know I have one of those, you know, those, is it a bracelet you can buy for a missing US serviceman? I have one of those, and I've looked him up and everything. So there's, people's children never met their parents or their fathers because they died in Vietnam. And also as well, like for the Vietnamese, this is not history, is it?
No. Memory is a really complicated, you know, historians and social scientists and cultural studies, you know, memory is a really complicated term. It's a big bucket of stuff. It involves individual memory, social memory, that is the kind of interactions of groups and the way in which groups kind of organize each other's sort of thoughts on the past, and that includes academic historians too. And then there's sort of official memory, which is kind of like the memory that's expressed at a kind of governmental level. And of course, all of these things are affected by each other. Individual memories are incredibly diverse, as you can imagine. In the United States, you only have to sort of think about the differences that might exist between the way in which, the way in which different races might have experienced the war differently. People in different regions. The South is generally the kind of the place which where most of the soldiers are drawn from, or at least it's the region that contributes most in terms of military personnel to the Vietnam War. It may have a different perception of the war than like a college town in the American North. Gender makes a difference, clearly. Class makes a difference. It's a working class war for the most part. It's the poor who are going to fight rather than the middle class who can get college deferments and draft deferments.
Bush Jr. does.
Sorry,
Bush Jr. didn't he get deferment
because he and Donald Trump too.
A lot politically, yeah,
and Donald Trump too. There's people like Dick Cheney and there's a sort of generation of people who oversaw policymaking at an international level a generation later who found ways not to fight in the Vietnam war. By the 1980s, you're starting to get, I think, in the United States, this kind of two major conformations of memory around kind of different narratives of the war. But they both sort of involve a similar kind of argument about betrayal. So there's the kind of anti-war memory, which is a generation betrayed by leaders who sort of pulled a generation into sort of fighting an unnecessary war in Vietnam. And then there's the kind of what we might call the more kind of right-wing or military memory of a generation of soldiers who were betrayed by leaders who refused to do what was necessary to win the war. Whose heart was not in the fight, or who were betrayed. That generation was betrayed by an anti-war press or an anti-war movement. An official memory, government expressed memory, is often sought to kind of triangulate between those two conformations. It's tried to sort of honor the sacrifice of those who fought, whilst also acknowledging the perception of many Americans that the Vietnam War was not a war that needed to be fought. It wasn't a war of necessity. But of course, added to this, we also have the fact that there's quite a lot of South Vietnamese in the United States as well. They come over in 1975 and in subsequent years, and we're starting to having to really kind of deal with that presence within American culture and the way it's been, to some extent, that ignored. There's a great novel that came out a couple of years ago by Nguyen Van Thanh called The Sympathizer, which won the Pulitzer Prize, and it's about a kind of South Vietnamese exile in the United States. And it's really kind of incredible when you teach students, you get students to read that novel, and they realize there's this whole other thing that they haven't thought about. I mean, to go on to Vietnam memories of the conflict initially are very kind of strongly disciplined by the official ideology of the Socialist Republic of Vietnam, which kind of emphasizes the heroism of the struggle as a battle against kind of capitalism and imperialism and so on. But it's very uncomfortable with encouraging the sort of individual acts of mourning and memory that local communities and local families may want to engage with, because it's still a kind of officially atheistic regime. And a lot of these acts involve thinking about kind of ghosts and spirits and religion and so on. So that's a kind of complicating factor. There's a whole kind of buried experience of the war and experience of the sort of memory of the war that the official ideology doesn't really reflect. And then we get the kind of opening up of Vietnam in the 1990s, where a whole new set of kind of issues emerge. There's money to be made from American backpackers. There's money to be made from nostalgic American veterans, but you don't necessarily want to lecture them on war crimes. And so we sort of end up with this kind of weird regression to the sort of wartime dislocations, where the power of American money overwrites the memory the sort of memory discourse of the Vietnamese state, which in turn has overwritten the private suffering of Vietnamese civilians. But there is some scope for these sort of transactions to be more hopeful and more thoughtful. And I think that's important. I remember looking through the visitor's book at the My Lai Memorial. And this is something I kind of quote in my book. And it's a sort of entry from a visitor who came from Seattle, and it's written in December in 2003, the first year of the sort of second Gulf War. And he posted a photograph of two sleeping grandchildren into the book. And he wrote, when I think of the atrocities that took place here, I think of them. Those who died here were the great future of this beautiful country. While it is said that we learn from history, I doubt, for once again, we are in turmoil. And I think that's a really, it shows that somebody has been to the country and it's and has experienced a sort of a memory site, and it's and is beginning to think differently. And in quite complicated ways about what this means, how far we can learn from it.
Kendrick, I always can guarantee that when somebody from Southampton comes on, they're going to knock it out of the park. And I'm not even saying that from a position of bias as a Southamptonian. genuinely, this is why I love kind of calling on people from the department to come and talk to us, because you just blow us away with not only the history, but also the eloquence with which you put this stuff across. And again, I'm not even saying that because you're one of my bosses. So thank you so much.
He never crawls like that for me.
I just organize your life for you, Alex.
Yeah, this is true.
That's the equivalent.
Chief of staff. No, it was brilliant. It's finally on History Hack, we've had a great overview of the Vietnam War to tell people why it happened and who was there and what they were doing and what their aims were. We've done some specific battle things, but we've not yet done this. So thank you very much.
You're welcome. I enjoyed it. Thanks very much for your questions.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, the 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them, and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/historyhack. Or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support, and here's to your next great book.